apocalyptic in doing this is intended to build up and comfort suffering saints. And so that this imagery is not just to make people wig out, but ultimately it's designed to make a deeply comforting impression upon them.
Welcome to Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable Podcast, a broadcast where the faculty of Mid-America discuss everything from Reformed theology, cultural issues, and all things seminary. This is episode 71, and I'm your host, Jared Luchibor, Director of Marketing. Thank you for joining us. Last time on the show, Reverend Compton elaborated a little bit on reading the Bible in high def, a method that is aimed at helping us to see and understand what is going on in biblical prophecy. He takes that method in today's episode and applies it to a bizarre passage of scripture in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, and the vision of the four beasts. Take a listen.
Well, we talked a bit about reading strategies. And as you can see, I didn't even go into really hermeneutical strategies. We talk about different ways in which the prophets wrote in specific ways for lack of better terms, to encode their message. But there are some things that we can do. We mostly, in our last episode, talked about the general need to be better readers. And I hope people aren't insulted by that, because some people really have kept up their readings. But let's not, we should never downplay the very real problem the church is facing right now, and that is an increasingly illiterate populace who have no problem with that, and yet we're trying to reach them with a fundamentally book-oriented religion. Mm-hmm. We were talking in the break there, TLDR.
Technically, when you see it written out, it's TL colon DR.
Too long didn't read. Yep.
Yeah. So people will, link to our long articles on social media, and in the comments section, they'll reference the TLDR version.
Okay.
For those of you who don't care to read,
goodness.
Here you go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always been a place for cliff notes and
right.
things like that, but you know, there are other kinds of things. We're not going to really camp out here. That would be kind of its own thing. But, you know, sometimes the prophets used what is called prophetic foreshortening. So, or telescoping is another expression for foreshortening. And the idea is that the prophets would create something of a constellation of images. And it sounds like they're all about to take place at once. But in fact, they are. They're spread over a bunch of different periods. Classic case, of course, this is a very debated one, but the Olivet Discourse, for example, starting in Matthew 24, a hotbed for discussion between our brothers and sisters who are dispensationalists and those of us who are covenantal and more amillennial or postmillennial or whatever in our thinking. But right, it starts off. The disciples come to Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 3, saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Okay, what things? Well, the verse prior, maybe I should have just read that. "Do you not see all these things?" He's pointing to the temple buildings all around him. "Do you not see all these things? Truly, I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." And so his disciples say, oh, well, if he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, that's got to be the end of the age. So they're asking him that way. And he goes on to actually depict both the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and the end of the age, the end of all things. But he kind of intertwines them, because our Lord is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophets. He's using that same idiom. John the Baptist did the same thing even earlier on in the book, where he's giving his reference to the fact that here comes the Messiah now, and at the same time, judgment is about to happen.
Mm.
Well, yes, in one sense, judgment did break in on Calvary, proleptically. But John, like another good Old Testament prophet, is telescoping events. He's bringing together seemingly disparate events into the same picture to help aid their associations. And the great example that's often used, Kim Riddleberger used to always use this in in his teaching, and I think even in his books he's done this. Outside of Los Angeles was the San Gabriel Mountains, and as you would drive toward them, you would seem to see one ridge, but the closer you got, and once you began to drive into the mountains, you'd see that actually these were a sequence of ridges. And the same kind of thing with prophecy.
Sure.
A lot of times we have things that look like one just kablam bunch of events, but that's because literarily they're being associated, whereas historically they will prove to unfold over a long period of time. Joel, the prophet, does the same thing if somebody wants to see how the day of the Lord finds a proximate and an ultimate fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And another, so that would be our telescoping or our foreshortening technique. But another technique that's used is the prophetic idiom, where the glories of the age to come are depicted using the kinds of ceremonies and symbols of the Old Covenant. And I'm struck by even Ezekiel's temple, where here is this picture of the heavenly temple, kind of this eschatological heavenly reality descending to earth. There's a lot of cosmic implications. Certainly there's Christological implications. Christ is the true temple. But Christ is the new creation. And we see that this new temple is drawing on that new creation age to come imagery. Although, interestingly, all the priests in this new temple have to be careful not to pass impurity on to one another. And they have to have certain kinds of offerings for accidental sins. And you think, what? Is there sin in the age to come?
Mm-hmm.
Or a classic one is from Ezekiel, where it talks about in that day, you know, what is the wording? You know, one will not die.
Right.
Except that until they've...
Isaiah.
What did I say?
Ezekiel.
Did I? I think everything's about Ezekiel. You kind of get caught up in
there. Or in the end of Zechariah also.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's not that there's death in the age to come, but rather this is these are techniques being used to draw upon the known realities of the theocracy, the known realities of Israel and its symbolic system, in order to depict the glories of the age to come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do know there's some good friends of mine who actually think Isaiah is describing the current epoch in which we live, which explains the deaths. So my brothers and I will take that up over coffee, I'm sure. But at least in one sense, we see that there is this idiom that does function elsewhere, even if they wanted to debate particular passages of it. But anyhow. Well, those are some broader kinds of themes, but I thought it'd be interesting to look at one set of images. You know, just looking at Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, we've got these... listen to some of this and tell me if you can't almost hear a similar impulse to what we saw in Ezekiel last time. Daniel 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed, and then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. And the chapter will go on, but at least maybe it's worth just stopping there a moment. It's going to go on and describe the Ancient of Days seated on his throne and the books of judgment opened and the Son of Man coming and being given the kingdom. And in the second half of the chapter, more of that will be unpacked. But right, we've kind of been oriented to, okay, this is high def, right? Let's start with that. Because a lot of interpreters right away want to say, okay, who are the four beasts? Who do they represent? Look, I'm not against that. In fact, one thing I've been striving to do in my own approach to Daniel is to avoid one of two sort of gutters. I don't mean to put people in the gutter, but, you know, you read some interpreters, and the only thing they're really concerned about is connecting the historical dots. They want to say, which beast is that? Aha, it's that person. Boom, done and done. And then there's other people who kind of say, well, it's fuzzy. We can't be entirely confident about some of these associations. Therefore, let's just not really deal with any predictive element and how these might relate to known entities or known people or known countries. Let's just keep this in the realm of impression. And we see the fear, the tumult. Well, again, the reason I call those gutters is because I don't want to concede any of that. Again, apocalyptic literature, as high def, is conveying this message in very powerful ways. Something I didn't add last time, but should point out this time, is that apocalyptic, in doing this, is intended to build up and comfort suffering saints. And so that this imagery is not just to make people wig out, but ultimately it's designed to make a deeply comforting impression upon them. That's, again, good reason to really get good at reading it. This is one vehicle God has for comforting us. So I don't want to lose any of that. But on the other hand, I don't want to detach it from the very real ebbing and flowing. That there is a real topography to history that the Bible does map onto. And so I think our interpretation should really capture the best of what both of these different positions are trying to do. But anyway, with these kingdoms, I mean, look at the kinds of creatures. It didn't say, you know, oh, I looked, there was the first creature, it was like a meerkat, and then the second creature was like a tiny little hamster, and the third creature was like a sparrow. And it's like, no, look at these things. They're big, burly creatures that are bent on causing destruction.
And almost like not even ones that are associated with ones that we're familiar with, because it uses the word like.
Yeah, I mean, you have that, exactly, you have that simile.
Yeah.
Being generated. And one of the, like the fourth one, he doesn't even try to connect it with anything. He just says it's a big, terrible beast with iron teeth.
Yeah.
I don't want to face that. But the others, too, notice how freaky they are. I mean, they're not. I saw this, and I thought this was a really good observation. I don't remember if this was Trevor Longman or Ian Duguid who pointed out, right, think of Israel's laws in Leviticus about not interbreeding species or not intermixing different types of plants, or even the cloth thing, right? Not allowing cloth. And some of us just think, what? You can't wear polyester? No! But the point of that is Leviticus is really trying to undergird the fact that creation is made in God's purposes and God's plan, each according to its kind. God has an order to creation. And so those expressions of the law are less about keeping people from planting two kinds of seeds. Yes, it did that, but it did that to help highlight that there's an order to creation. And then that's why you have these distinctions that are kept. But look at these creatures. There's no distinctions.
Right.
These are just these, you know, the stormy, chaotic sea belches out these, you know, these chaotic looking
monsters.
Anti-creational monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yet what we're then longing for. Oh, and then we see these monsters. There's four of them, right? Again, the four compass points. You can right away start thinking of a totality. The one beast has 10 horns. People have tried to say, oh, those are the 10 permanent members of the European Union. Mm-hmm. Aha. Well, we got some challenges because the text doesn't seem to indicate that there's any kind of a gap between the fourth beast and this 10-member union. But you kind of need to posit a gap from the end of the Roman Empire in, what, the 4th and the 7th centuries, or when did that end? Only Dr. Strange was here. He knows these modern issues in church history. That for me, my knowledge ends with the Iron Age. Everything else is just recent. But my point being, though, you have these creatures that are chaotic, coming out of a chaotic sea, and they are oppressing the people of God. And here's this horn leading it. These 10 horns indicate a fullness as well. Back in Daniel 1, Daniel and his friends are said to be 10 times better than the Babylonians. It's not that they got, you know, the Babylonians bench pressed 100 pounds and they each bench pressed 1,000 pounds. It's not like literal 10, you know, but 10 fits into that wholeness number, that completeness number. And so the same kind of a picture going on here. But yet we see these beasts warring against the people of God. He goes on, maybe I should just keep reading a bit here. Verse 9, I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. Oh, that's the wheels I was thinking about in our last episode, right? Ezekiel has the wheels connected with God's glory. Look here.
Yeah.
The Ancient of Days associated with wheels on his throne. I think that's no accident.
Right.
Anyway, verse 10, a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I looked, I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. So here's the end of the one beast and the horn, right? Here was the boastful words, and interesting how, look at some of the associations. That fourth beast had 10 horns, and this is going to, we're going to see later that this is, in fact, I think we could skip ahead and show how verses 17 and 18 sort of boil down the whole account. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. That's like, you know, if you really want to get down to the too long didn't finish thing, like it's verses 17 and 18. But so here's these beasts, right? And the one has 10 horns and it's arising from the earth and it's oppressing the people of God. And yet the Ancient of Days comes not with 10, but with thousands upon thousands, indeed 10,000 upon 10,000. Are standing before him. Myriads upon myriads is what the New American Standard has here, but different people have rendered that. Look at these contrasts between the greatness of the Ancient of Days, who is so much more powerful even than these larger-than-life, high-death-conceived creatures, these beasts, who attack the people of God. Now, we'll say a little more about the horn that came up in our next podcast. We'll talk about Chapter 8, which also features a horn. But notice how at the end of Daniel, starting in verse 15, the angel interprets this vision in a bit more detail, although he doesn't exactly solve it for him, because he doesn't say, this refers to the European Union, which will be founded in 19, whatever that was. And there will be some guys in 2021 sitting in a room in a state called Indiana. Well, right, it could do all that, but it doesn't. So it still stays somewhat general, even though the angel does give him some interpretation. But he does say in verse 20, 21, you know, the horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints. Then verse 23, he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and will intend to make alterations in times and law, and they will be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. Right, here is this this beast is going to attack the people of God, and even at times overpower them, until the Ancient of Days arrives. And he says he'll do it for a time, times, and half a time. Now, we can't really unpack all these details right now. I'd really like to, but just for the sake of time. But, you know, people hear that number, time, times, and half a time, and they say, oh, 3.5 years, and there's been the dispensational school of thinking. That means that this will just happen for the second half of the so-called Great Tribulation. But, you know, in reality, that expression of time, times, and half a time refers to the period of history in which we live today.
Mm-hmm.
It goes by other terms, too. 42 months is an expression sometimes used. 1,260 days. 3.5 years, right? These are all time stamps used to describe this epoch, or other names as well. The tribulation, I think even the Great Tribulation at times is predicated of the entire age, even if there is a time toward the end where there's increasing lawlessness. The millennium, the last days, John even calls this the last hour. We live in the last hour and have for 2,000 years. Look how that relates to what we find in verse 18, where we have an incredible contrast made, right? We read that this beast and this horn will attack the people of God for times, time, and half a time. But if you go to verse 18, that's nothing compared to the forever, forever, and ever that is depicted there. It's almost an identical Hebrew, or this is Aramaic here, but almost an identical Aramaic construction between the two. You know, times, time, half a time, forever, forever, and ever. And we just get this picture of God's superiority and destruction so that no matter what the church faces as it is being oppressed by this fourth beast, some have tried to nail that down to Greece. Others have said Rome. I think a new commentary by Joe Sprinkle even describes it as Roman beyond, you know. But the church has faced oppression from this beast, will continue to face oppression by this beast. At times will even be defeated and the beast will prevail over us. But this is only for times, time, and half a time. The Lord will come and eradicate this threat, and the saints will possess the kingdom now not just for an equal amount, for times, times, and half a time, but they will possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever.
Reading Scripture in High Def, Prophetic Telescoping. Next time on Roundtable, Reverend Compton will dive into typology and the tyrant and oppressor of God's people, also in the book of Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes, who is this man? Is he a type of someone to come? Learn this and more next week on Roundtable. For more episodes, you can find us on our website and wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Be sure to search for and subscribe to Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable. I'm Jared Luchabor. Till next time.